A man trying to understand himself has tried to orient his own place in the larger pattern of universal activity. This has perhaps led to a kind of escape mechanism which we do observe also in the pages of history. One of the best ways to get our minds off of the small and immediate business of self-improvement is to become absorbed in some cosmic scheme. It is so easy for us to enjoy a kind of intellectual gymnastics in which the mind becomes greatly intrigued with its own findings and keeps on exploring, perhaps not the facts of things, but its own capacities in application to world knowledge. We do, however, find that there are certain archetypal thoughts that we cannot actually trace to any one source. They seem to have descended to us, perhaps at first in very simple form, from the first imaginings, the first speculations, the first intuitions of primitive mankind, always confronted by and surrounded by the unknown. Man has tried to conquer it in every way that he could. On the physical plane of things, he has achieved considerable. But in the abstract realms, mystery has still conquered him. This evening, we want to summarize in some simple pattern those kingdoms of nature which seem to share with us the habitation of this planet. Looking out from the centers of awareness in our own natures, we are aware of a world. We are aware that this world is full of living things, that these living things are by nature and substance magnificent. Some of them are antipathetical to ourselves. We have to struggle against them. Primitive man against the great beasts of the world in which he lived. Modern man against microorganisms, weed, and devil grass. But although some things do not seem very friendly, each of the forms of life that we can study is a wonder world of its own. It is easy to understand why enthusiastic, sensitive human beings have devoted their entire lives to some one small type of growing thing. Huge books have been written about ferns and lichens. Man has never ceased to wonder at the order, the mathematical precision, and yet the wonderful dramatic flair that is present everywhere in nature. He has tried to moralize upon natural things, and we have had ages of fables, like Aesop's and Fontaine's, where man invested other creatures with human attributes, not only to understand those creatures, but perhaps through their native habits to understand himself a little better, as he recognized these same habits in his own life. But however we wish to approach this particular phase of the subject, we do acknowledge that this world, this earth, this little bit of land we call our own, is truly a garden of wonders, and that here we see truly an infinite unfoldment of infinite life. Even today, on the level of our hyper-intellectualism, however, we have overlooked one point, which it seems to me is valid and has been recognized long before our own time. This point is that what we see is limited by our own sensory perceptions. We are looking out at nature, but we are not seeing all of it. This we have to generally acknowledge. We are not only limited as to how much we can see of certain things. But we are limited by the total band of our sensory perceptions. Anything that is outside of our own faculty power to discern simply does not exist. Sometimes, some evidence of other things may come to our attention, as occasionally a mariner at sea will discover some form of life from far below the surface that has come to the surface either in death or in some phenomenal circumstance. Actually, however, we are limited to organisms composed of materials which we can comprehend, which we can contact in some way through the sensory perceptions which we possess. Another point that I think is rather valid and important is that when we are trying to understand our own sensory functions and reach the extremities or the boundaries of our sensory faculties, we seem to come not to a blur, but to a hard line of demarcation. It would seem as though some kind of a wall exists beyond our sensory contacts. Things do not seem to drift on into the invisible. They seem to have sharp boundaries, and we pass from that which we can see very clearly almost immediately to that which we cannot see at all. There is no twilight zone here of things partly within our sensory perceptions and partly outside. This is true at both ends of this gamut of perceptive power. At the lower end, we pass down into the mineral kingdoms and perhaps a wee bit further. And then suddenly we are in the midst of the invisible. As we ascend, we go through the estate of man, the highest creature that we are able to actually cognize. And immediately beyond man again is the unknown. We are not able to see the trailing robes of some superior order. They remain invisible. Man, however, has developed certain extra faculties, and under some special conditions, these seem to reveal a little more than our ordinary perceptions would include. But what these extrasensory perceptions seem to mostly do is to reveal a little more about the things which we already see. Perhaps, for example, we can observe the magnetic fields of bodies. We have already seen the bodies. We see just a little more of the energies which maintain them, energies which we have long assumed to exist, because even from the beginning there were these persons with extrasensory faculties which gave record or reported these things. They were not always believed in their own time, but the tradition lingers, and as we come to a more adequate knowledge in our present day, we are confirming far more of antiquity than we are disproving. But we are in a world in which, for practical purposes, we see about us four essential kingdoms. And the Paracelsians and the Greeks, some of the Asiatic peoples, related these kingdoms to the elements and gave us the general arrangement that there are apparent to us in this world four ascending orders of organic structural life. The lowest of these, we sometimes question whether it is organic or not, but at least it is visible. It is an integration. It is a compound. And from this compound, we can gain certain insight because we can see it. We can touch it. We can know it by such faculties as we possess. Therefore, the lowest of our kingdoms is the mineral. And above the mineral is the plant. Above the plant, the animal. And above the animal, man. We make this differentiation not without certain arbitrary consistency. There is certainly a clear distinction between minerals and plants. There are, however, forms of life that seem to act as bridges between these, such as the lichen, where we seem to see growing minerals. And the Paracelsians tell us that all the elements in the earth are growing minerals, but their growth is so slow that we are unable to notice it. But this growth is responsible for the vein-like structures of minerals in the earth. Between the plant and the animal, there is also a fairly clear line of obvious demarcation. The animal has additional faculties, powers, sensitivities, which we are not able to see in plants. Yet again, there are plants that seem to be developing nervous systems and organisms. We know, for instance, the flycatcher plant, which not only moves, but lives upon animal or insect food. We also realize that there are other forms of plants, like the sensitive plant, capable of motion. Many different links seem to bind these worlds together also, but the realms themselves are comparatively clearly marked. Then between animal and man, there seems to be a greater kinship and still a clear line of demarcation. Some would like to assume that man is but a highly cultivated anthropoid. If they so wish to assume, I guess there's nothing we can do about it. But there seems to be some doubt about this, that actually there is a difference, perhaps more in quality than in appearance, more in psyche than in material structure. But certainly there is a clear distinction between animal and man. And in the animal world in general, we group together other orders of life, as insects and birds and fishes. We group them together, considering most of them as in some way related to the animal kingdom. Then we place over this kingdom man. We might want to say that he is part of the animal world because he is a mammal. We might want to say that he is merely a beast on his hind legs, and some certainly seem to support this point of view. But all in all, man seems to be a creature peculiarly possessed or obsessed by a kind of mental force, a mental principle. Man is certainly the only animal that actually measures the duration of its own life. Man is the only animal, probably, that kills for pleasure. Man is the only animal that can worry about the future or regret the past. Man is the only animal, also, that has to be educated because its natural instincts have failed. Thus, man seems to have a uniqueness about him, and some people like to assume that the simian is a kind of link between the animal and the man. Even as the various lichens are links between the mineral and the vegetable kingdoms. So we finally come to this point where man seems to stand upon the apex of this way of life. We don't see anything beyond man, and even if we think we're going to have a visitor from Mars, he turns out to look very much like us. So that with the exception of certain possible overtones, we see very little beyond the human state. Visibly, our faculties seem to go no further. We are not able to actually see a form of life superior to man, except in the large, abstract, astronomical sense, in which we can see suns and planets and luminaries, which perhaps in many ways belong to a race of giants in the sky. But man has become the boundary of our faculties, because it is only with our own humanity that we judge, and we can judge only our own humanity or those degrees or steps which led directly to it, which we call the other kingdoms of nature. But when we study man, we have to move now into another dimension, because that which makes man man and separates him from the beast is not visible. We cannot reach our understanding of this part of the problem simply by following the old patterns of natural history. We have to look for something else. And it has gradually come to our realization that man must be approached as a mental pattern, that it is by his mind that we are able to discover what we can know about him. Certainly, we can understand his body by dissection. We can understand many of his physical propensities by reference to other kingdoms. But the man himself is a different kind of being. As soon as we begin to explore this a little further, we make an interesting discovery that all human beings are not alike. Now, in this, we are not referring to racial differentiations. We are referring to a kind of psychological difference. And our classical philosopher friends of long ago found it convenient, finally, to divide humanity itself into three orders, different levels or grades or subdivisions within man himself. The precedence for this is also to be found in other kingdoms of nature. There is more than one level of mineral life, more than one level of vegetable life, and certainly more than one level of animal life. We know that these differences exist in visible structure. Now we are forced to examine them in psychological structure. And in this search into the nature of man, we divide him inevitably into three types of humanity. We can say that one of these types is the human man. Another type is the animal man. And the third type is the spiritual or divine man. These all look alike, perhaps some differences, noticeable in organic quality or structure. And these differences may also be marked upon the lineaments of the face. We find that different levels of consciousness seem to shine out. But this shine is itself a rather psychological situation about which we are not too sure in terms of physical facts. But we do recognize these three types of human beings. We find one type of human being that lives and dies essentially on a level of animal existence. And what is animal existence in this case? It is a condition perfectly right and proper to animals, but not right and proper to the best in man. Such animal man, if we can so differentiate him, is therefore one in whom the animal propensities predominate and dominate the life. The animal man is the individual who lives for the gratification of appetite. The animal man is the person who lives fully for the fulfillment of creature comforts. The animal man is also the hunter. He is the prowler. He is the creature ever struggling to live. We like to think of man as having human attributes of a kind. When man becomes obviously cruel, we tie him to the cruelty of lower kingdoms. Now, these kingdoms may not actually be cruel, but to us they are. We see the cat playing with the mouse. And to us, this is cruelty. And when we see a human being playing with the life or soul or consciousness of another human being, we call this cruelty. So we observe that there is the animal man, whose expressions, motivations, and attitudes and efforts are limited almost entirely to the level of appetites. Then we distinguish the human man. The human man is the one who is making a reasonably adequate use of the essential faculties of his own humanity. In other words, the animal man is the man of appetite, the human man is the man of thoughtfulness. Thoughtfulness does not necessarily mean great scholarliness. Thoughtfulness is simply the use of the mind for the normal purpose of regulating the life into a constructive pattern. The human man uses his thoughts to ensure the protection of his loved ones, the securities of his own values. He uses his faculties as constructively as he knows how. He has certain aspirations, certain convictions. He is above the corruption of his own code. He will not do those things which cause him to degrade his own humanity. The third kind of man is the divine man. This was the hero of the ancient Greeks and of other Nordic peoples. The divine man represents the highest aspiration of human endeavor, as this is exemplified in the conduct of human beings. The divine man is the great teacher, the sage, the saint, the wise man, the great creative artist, the musician. He is the person whose faculties seem to transcend the ordinary humanity of things. He seems to have skills greater than can reasonably be expected. But perhaps the faculties which most distinguish him are creativity and intuition. These faculties surely indicate that he has developed something beyond the creature comforts or daily needs or traditional patterns of human life. The ancients realized that there were, therefore, these three kinds of persons. And from this, they began to contemplate and did clearly differentiate three distinct patterns of mental activity. These patterns of mental activity ascended until finally they reached their highest expression in what we might term the God-man or the God-man concept. Probably we haven't seen very many God-men walk upon the earth, although we are told that they did in days long gone by. But we do sense that genius, that specialization, that the infinite wisdom and compassion and insight of man can be hypothetically assumed to reach a final state of excellence in which all that is possible for man to accomplish in his humanity is accomplished by him. We then say, what lies beyond this? We have carried man to the highest point we know. We have already discovered that the thing that makes him man is no longer visible. So we begin to wonder what might lie beyond him. Are there other orders of life that can truly be said to have existence? Are there more kingdoms? And in mysticism and in the sacred scriptures of most peoples, the implications of other kingdoms are rather clearly noted. We hear, for example, of angelic beings, invisible, but evidently assumed to exist somewhere in the mysterious depths of intangible space. Then we proceed to the archangelic hosts, a still higher, more exalted order of life, referred to by St. Paul. We then can go on to other orders, still more exalted, thrones, dominions, principalities, seraphim, all types of mysterious names for something that transcends our sensory perception. The philosophers came to the very simple solution that what we see of the kingdoms of nature are the visible rungs of a ladder, and that these rungs continue to ascend behind the clouds which obscure our sensory perception, and that all these rungs or levels together represent a great theater of evolutionary process, that just as surely as we can trace growth from the least to the most of visible things, so this growth goes on and on into higher orders that we do not have the faculty to perceive. The philosophic thought about this is rather clear if we wish to rationalize it, namely that what we do see cannot exist without the presence of other things we do not see. The visible cannot be suspended in a vacuum. The visible is obviously a part of something. It is as though we saw the trunk of a tree, but we cannot see the branches or the roots. Yet the trunk of the tree requires that the root be there, whether we know it or not. And the trunk of the tree also implies that the branches will also be there above, although we cannot see them. For without the root and the branch, the trunk of the tree has no purpose for its own existence. This type of thinking was used in ancient times. Now, an interesting parallel speculation relating to this is to go to the lower end of our ladder and try to determine, if we can, what lies beneath the mineral levels. The moment we begin to think in terms of this, our physical perceptions and our mathematical skills begin to break up matter into invisible units, which finally become units of energy. Thus, we assume that all things physically, less than the mineral, are to be determined by still more elementary compounds, until in some hypothetical point in the remote distance of belowness, we come finally to the common denominator of everything, life itself. So the physicist and the physical thinker is simply prepared to allow that the mystery of growth extends downward into forms that we cannot fully or truly see, or which we can recognize only as parts of higher organisms, until at last nothing remains but a mathematical formula which can be diagrammed but which cannot directly be contemplated in its substance or its reality by any faculty that we possess, even with the aid of the most powerful microscopes and other scientific instruments. The ancients had a little different attitude about this. They contemplated the possibility that these lower kingdoms actually were also orders of entities, that they represented kingdoms of growing things, of which the mineral was a summit for them, just as man is a summit for the visible patterns of evolution. To understand this, we must approach our problem in another way, and that is to try to determine what constitutes aliveness, what constitutes the moving consciousness of things, as these things become less and less obvious to our sensory perception. We can take one that is comparatively simple for our present purpose and use it as a key to all the others. What about the mineral? Minerals, gems, metals, and other mysterious substances, elements within the structure of the physical matter of Earth, what do these formations have in the term of consciousness? We contemplate them. We say to ourselves, they do not move. Therefore, they do not have plant consciousness as we understand it. We are not yet ready entirely to accept the Paracelsian theory that they grow, but we must come to this perhaps. Certainly, they share with the plant kingdom a magnificent coloration. There are all kinds of wonderful colors hidden in the earth. They also have some kind of participation in the great geometry of existence. For many of them, particularly crystals, in their fission show regular mathematical progressions of forms. These same minerals do not have voice. They do not have digestive systems. They do not have any of the general faculties that we know of animals. We sense no emotion and no passion in them. So we go on and we say also they are lacking the human faculties. We have no proof that minerals can think. We have no actual proof, however, of very much of anything about minerals, except their forms and their colors, and such organizations of them as we may make in mineralogy for our own satisfaction. Suppose we say to ourselves now, are there other dimensions of consciousness, different from our own? Man growing up through these kingdoms has been objectifying certain consciousness faculties. He has gradually built an instrument capable of maintaining human consciousness. Suppose we say to ourselves, where was this consciousness before these bodies were built? Did consciousness, as the material scientist would like to suggest, simply result from growth? And if consciousness resulted from growth, what directed growth? We must either assume that there is some law or pattern superior to growth, or else growth itself becomes pretty much of an impossibility. What is the nature of this growing something that bursts through all of the kingdoms of nature? What is this life that is struggling upward by this great evolutionary process? What is this power that is building ever nobler mansions for its soul? This is a good question, but not a popular one at the moment. For even after all this time, these ages of thought and speculation, we have no valid answer that can be accepted by the scientifically trained person. He will not accept reason, no matter how reasonable it may be. But he may have to someday, because there is no other approach to this problem unless man can break through the barriers of faculty limitation which he now possesses. Suppose we would like to say for a moment that consciousness is not only growing upward, but is moving outward or across a line between subjectivity and objectivity. That consciousness itself, in the process of moving into embodiment, moves from a certain place to a certain place. And that in this motion, consciousness itself passes through changes or modifications. The philosophers of old liked to assume that there was an archetypal consciousness that made up as a unit, as a total pattern of itself, the so-called seven kingdoms of nature. This archetypal consciousness was one being, moving into embodiment through seven levels or steps. And that what we call evolution is the evolution of the essential consciousness of the earth itself through the various stages and levels of which both the mineral and the man are manifestations. If this consciousness per se has an existence apart from body, and this, of course, is the great moot question. If this consciousness has an existence apart from body, then by some circumstance, purpose, will, or law, it moves into embodiment, taking upon itself a body as though by a quickening, coming into manifestation gradually through the unfoldment of its own faculties and powers, each of which, as it unfolds, provides itself with an instrument suitable for that unfoldment. Under such conditions, the mineral is the mineral state of that consciousness. The plant is the plant state of that consciousness. The animal state. Man, the human state. And beyond this, the other states of that consciousness are simply beyond the grasp of humanity, but must certainly also exist. That there must be conditions superior to man seems to have been generally conceded, one of the evidences being that man can slowly, surely, and by a long and painful process become superior to himself. Therefore, there must be a superior condition into which he can move. The next situation that becomes perhaps a little interesting to us is to try to understand the kingdoms of nature in reference to the planet itself. Most of the Oriental peoples and many of the classical philosophers took it for granted that the planet Earth was alive. They were not inclined to agree with the medieval theologians that it was merely a footstool shoved under man to prevent him from falling indefinitely. It seemed rather to them that the planet was a being, a living thing. And because it was alive, even though, as we suggested before, it might be considered an embryo, still not fully born. But because it is alive, it is able to support life. And because it is alive, it is also capable of unfolding the conditions of life itself. So the ancients had the tendency to assume that the planet was a living organism, and that this organism consisted of a series of energy fields, or invisible parts of itself, plus a visible part. The invisible parts were called planes, and these planes represented nothing more nor less than the magnetic field of the planet itself. And the ancient Tibetan mystics assumed that the planet was to be defined as seven within and seven without. The crust of the planet, its surface, therefore was the lowest of seven rings that descended to the archezoic core of the planet itself. Thus the planet had beneath its surface a kind of solar system. And this solar system became more and more powerful, more and more positive, as it retired from the surface down toward the center, so that the highest vibration of the Earth was in its center and the lowest in its circumference. Thus, the surface of the Earth was the outer body, or the epidermis, of a great living organism. The organs of this being, its various functions, being controlled by a septenary of powers within the Earth itself. This septenary being composed of magnetic centers that correspond very closely to the planets in the orbit of their orbits in a solar system. The seven arches of Enoch in the Bible, which led down, and in the midst thereof was the mysterious altar bearing the golden delta of Melchizedek. This, perhaps, was an ancient way of indicating the subterranean region. The initiation rites of ancient people were mostly given under the earth in caverns, and these caverns were often arranged like the Saptapana cave in India, where Buddha is said to have initiated his disciples. These subterranean regions, therefore, represented the inner structure or life of the planetary lord. And in the mysterious core of this planetary structure was seated, as in the heart, the final power of the planetary logos. From the surface of the earth outward, there was another manifestation, this the radiant auric field, which emanated from the surface of the earth, from the planetary power within. This radiating field had its lowest level where it joined the Earth's surface in its most exalted region in the circumference or outer area. And this magnetic field or aura was also stratified and had symbolic colors assigned to it, but not the colors that we can see with our eyes. So just as the human body has its own magnetic centers within and its auric field enveloping it, so the planet was similarly constructed. The ancients further then declared that the involutionary process consisted of the descent of organized life germs, the peculiar seed carried by the planetary power in the formation of its own planet, that these seeds falling gradually through the magnetic field outside of the earth finally descended to the earth itself. At the same time, from the core within the earth, another process was also moving. The earth was constantly producing from within itself the ascending orders of bodies. The Earth was providing from its outer magnetic field a descending order of lives. And these lives were soon to ultimately become embodied. And the meetings of these lives and their bodies became very, very important. In the course of incarnating these seed lives, created first these etheric or energy spindles, as they are referred to even now in cell fission. The mineral, for example, contained the lowest form body and was associated, therefore, by the least amount of vehicle contact with the entity that was to ensoul it. Thus it was that the original mineral magnetic energy moved upward, producing a series of bodies. The mineral gradually assumed the power of the plant. The plant assumed the propensities of the animal, and the animal gradually evolved into the form of man. At the same time that this procedure was taking place, entities themselves, seeking embodiment, were descending into union with these forms and creating bridges between themselves and these forms when the form was not strong enough or evolved enough to permit a full manifestation of the being. This is supposed in ancient times to be the secret of man, because man is the lowest form of body in which there can be a true or complete union of an incarnating power with its body. Man, therefore, is the lowest of the creations of the solar system in which its own spiritual germ can be incarnated. In all lower kingdoms, this germ must remain in the magnetic body fields of these creatures. It cannot enter into the body itself. The body is not able to maintain it. Therefore, in the lower kingdoms, the consciousness works upon the body. But in man, which is the lowest kingdom to be ensouled, the consciousness at quickening enters into the body and works through it. Now, this presents us with a very interesting pattern, where it begins to give us a suspicion that other kingdoms of nature are not without consciousness, but that consciousness is not tied to body, as it is in the case of man. Man is the creature who has to consciously recapitulate the mineral, plant, animal, and early human stages in the process of building his own body. He must recapitulate the age patterns of these kingdoms in the processes of his own growth. Now, if you will consider for a moment and go back to the Ptolemaic system of the solar system, you will realize that in the old geocentric system, the sun occupied the fourth orbit, the fourth from above and below of the seven different orbits of the ancient planetary system. The sun, therefore, became peculiarly identified with man, the luminous or the light power of the self-conscious being. The sun had to do with conscious intellect, the luminosity of self-knowing, and it was placed in the fourth division of the solar system, where Pythagoras, in his monochord, a great musical structure, placed the fret which formed the octave. Therefore, the octave became the symbol of the higher and lower halves of the string, and in man, the octave represents his own self-consciousness. In which the higher and lower halves of the string of his own vibratory energy meet by means of the fret of individualized mind. The Pythagoreans had quite a little to say and to think about this particular problem. One thing we do not know, and probably we will not know for some time with general certainty, although there may be a few who have intuited it in themselves, and that is, what is the consciousness of these living things while this consciousness is not involved in body? Can we say, for example, that the mineral has a conscious existence apart from body? I think we must assume that it does. We must also assume that the plant does. And we might also assume, if we so wished, that the consciousness of these lower kingdoms at this time may be greater than our own. The reason why it is greater is because it is not limited by involvement in body as ours is. The consciousness, therefore, is more in the state of the unborn being, the human being, before quickening. If we wish to assume that the consciousness of man only comes alive in the process of embodiment, as the materialist does, then we have no consciousness behind this process at all. But if we wish to assume that man coming into life is a living thing becoming embodied, then we must assume the same of the other kingdoms of nature. In relationship to our patterns, they may seem inferior. If our own consciousness could experience them, perhaps they might be inferior in certain particulars to man. Certainly they would be inferior in the experience of mortality. They would be inferior in the power to use and administer the faculties which man has unfolded and has ensouled with his own consciousness. Here we get very, very close to our Buddhist problem again. Namely, what is the state of consciousness for a creature that is not involved at all in any form of matter? What is the consciousness of the individual who has never assumed any of the limitations of human consciousness? The answer would appear to be that this consciousness would be nirvanic, that it would exist in an entirely different dimension from any that we know, that existing in this dimension, it may be perfect. It may be infinitely enlightened in comparison to ours. That it has to have some need or reason for embodiment should also be contemplated, however. That this consciousness perhaps then follows the parable of the prodigal son. For the good son who stayed at home was but slightly rewarded. For him there was no banquet, no feasting, because he was good. He was not rewarded. But the son who went forth as a prodigal and went through the cycle of sorrow and pain, and finally out of a resolution of his own soul, was determined to return to his father's house and ask forgiveness. For him, there was a banquet. And when the good son asked his father why, the father answered very simply, because this, the prodigal son, was lost and is found again, died and was born again. So apparently the involvement of consciousness in form is part of a great universal pattern of necessity. It is the great Greek spindle of necessity around which all things move. And in this concept, therefore, the consciousness which has not entered into form involvement must be deficient in something. But at the same time, it may also possess other things. If it is deficient in mind, it is also deficient in disobedience. If it has no virtue, it likewise has no vice. If it is not capable of pleasure, it can know no pain. And therefore, we observe the various kingdoms of nature growing up according to a strange and absolute integrity, which is missing in man. We observe how these kingdoms are perfectly administered, how the creatures of these kingdoms intuitively recognize their own needs, their own destiny, and fulfill. We have no way of knowing how the plant, from a standpoint of consciousness, functions. But as Leonardo da Vinci pointed out, the way in which branches come off of the stalk of a plant, the various patterns of its leaves and flowers indicate an absolute geometry beyond almost anything we can imagine. and all the great canons of art and beauty which man has evolved have arisen from his intuitive receptivity to natural processes. So we cannot say that the plant, which fulfills its destiny with infinite certainty, can be unconscious. We do know that it may possess a small measure of objective consciousness, that the objective reaction is beginning, and that the real abiding inner consciousness of the plant is moving toward involvement or embodiment, and is sensitively and intuitively and magnetically connected with the body of the plant, so that it may administer it and govern it and take care of it. Now, there is a theory or belief about these things that the consciousness of the various groups of the lower kingdoms has not been individualized. In other words, that one of the reasons for the peculiar uniformity which we observe in nature, a uniformity which, however, has a delightful expression in diversity. That this uniformity, this infallible relationship between its consciousness and its form, is simply due to the fact that the power of consciousness behind it is not individualized. The Paracelsians and other medieval Christian mystics believed in the group spirit theory. They held that individualization only takes place when a certain degree of an unfoldment has been achieved, and that man is also the lowest species in which individualization of consciousness has been attained. Thus, these other forms of life are under the control and direction of collective intelligences. Some of these group spirits and similar things undoubtedly were associated with the old concept of the elementals, or nature spirits. For nature spirits were believed in the old legendary and lore to be industriously engaged in various natural occupations. If you read the ancient legends of the Nibelungen, the little dwarfs that lived in the earth, or if you have read the rather gentle and gracious story of Undine, you realize something of the old legendary, namely that the elementals were concerned largely with the directing, controlling, and administering of the destinies of non-individualized life.